James Comer says that the media and scholars are obsessed with black family stories about victims. He thinks that we can learn more about overcoming obstacles by studying the stories of survivors. He offers his own family memoir as an example. His new book, Maggie's American Dream, opens with an oral history of his mother. She grew up in poverty and was denied an education, but she saw to it that all her children were educated. Her five children have acquired a total of 13 college degrees. Comer devotes the second half of his book to his own story. As he made his way through grade school and college, he carried the burden of always having to prove that blacks were capable of academic achievement. Comer's mother always told him that the way to get ahead was through education. He became an educator and child psychiatrist in the hopes of helping black children get the opportunities he'd had. Comer is professor of psychiatry at Yale Child Study Center. He created an experimental program that develops the social skills of elementary school children. After being credited with turning around two schools in New Haven, his program was adapted by other low-income, predominantly black schools in New Haven, as well as by several other cities. James Comer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. My pleasure being here.
I'd like to know, when you first asked your mother to sit down with you and tell you her story, what kind of reaction she had?
Well, she wasn't sure that she had a story that was worth telling, but she was willing to do it because I asked. And I really didn't have a book in mind at the time. I was just doing a family record for my own children because the story of my father and that interesting area of Comer, Alabama, where he was from, was all gone because the old-timers had passed away. And so I was just going to do a family record until I realized there was a larger story there.
Now, your mother really has an incredible story. She lived with her mother and her stepfather on the outskirts of Memphis. They lived in poverty. And the day she turned 16 and could legally leave home, she ran away.
Right.
What conditions were so bad at home that made her want to run away so much?
Well, she had a very good father who, until 5 years of age, when he was killed by lightning. And at that point, there was no safety net, and a man came along who said he was single, but he actually had another family in Memphis, and he took the family from Mississippi to Memphis, and they lived from house to house. They'd find empty homes or empty shacks and move into them, and they moved like vagabonds from place to place. And then at one point, they went up and down the river on a houseboat, and she was like a prisoner on that houseboat and lived in little shacks. And he was abusive, and he beat the family, and he wouldn't allow her to have an education or any of the family to have an education. And it was just miserable conditions all the way from the time she was six or so until she was 16.
She ran away to East Chicago, where one of her brothers had already run away.
Right.
When she was 16 and she got to East Chicago, she enrolled herself in an elementary school where she attended school with eight-year-olds. Why was she so determined to go to school?
Well, she always believed that education was the way out for her. Even when she was a little girl, she felt that the education was a way out from the abusive conditions. In that period, poor people and middle-income people lived in the same neighborhood. So she used to look out and see better-educated people going off to better jobs, and they had better cars and better homes and so on. And she said, I want to be like that. And so education became important to her. And she never allowed the abusiveness of her stepfather to beat her down or to convince her that she wasn't able to achieve or acquire things at a higher level. And I think that was largely because that first 5 years with her good father gave her a real sense of self as a positive person and good self-esteem. And so with her stepfather, she kind of bounced off of him. Whatever he stood for, she was for the opposite. And he was against education, therefore it must be good. And she could see what it did for other people, and she was determined that she was going to have that for herself. Now, when she couldn't get it for herself, she vowed that if she had children, all of her children would get an education.
And indeed they did.
That's right.
The man she married, your father, came from a very different background.
That's right. His family was from a church background, and it was much better organized. They were also a family that lived under the better conditions of slavery. The slave master was a reasonably progressive person for that period, and His son was the governor of Alabama in an earlier period, and my father had positive relationships with that family, and the Comer families, black and white, had reasonably good relationships. And there was, his grandfather was a minister, and his father was a minister. And there was a church culture that was very positive, and all of that was very organizing. On the other hand, my father only had a seventh grade education.
You know what I found very interesting? Your mother, when talking about her husband, your father,
yes,
frequently referred to him as Mr. Comer.
Right.
And this is when she was talking to you, her son.
Right. Well, I deliberately kept that in because that really conveyed her feeling, her respect for my father. Mr. Comer was the way she felt about him. He was a man of great dignity, and he was very caring, and she had great respect for him, and that's the way she felt.
Well, they both had a dream to make it. What was your mother's dream? You called your book Maggie's American Dream. What was her dream?
Well, my mother felt that we could all gain a college education and have better opportunities in life, and that she could make that possible. And that was her dream, that she and my dad together would make it possible for all five of us to achieve an education and have an opportunity to participate in the mainstream of American society.
She was so alert to the idea of always learning that when she was a domestic before the children were born and she'd go into the homes of white women to clean, she said she'd think of that as going to school, and she'd always
right.
pay attention to how things were done in that house to see if she could learn anything from it.
Yes, that's right. That was part of her plan. It was like she had a strategy for getting ahead, for gaining what was necessary to be successful in the mainstream of society. And part of that was to find out how the mainstream worked. And she worked for the highest socioeconomic families in the city and learned their ways of doing things, their ways of relating to the larger society. And she brought those home and used those in rearing her family. Now, she didn't accept everything. She didn't consider them better than her. There were certain things that she observed that she decided she did not want for her children, particularly arrogant, disrespectful behavior on the part of middle-income white children that she was caring for. On the other hand, there were certain ways of working, ways of performing that she observed, ways of working, caring for the children. She decided she wanted that for her own children. Now, she brought that home, and also our family was well organized and a part of an organizing and supportive church culture. And I think that combination of our own black church culture and what she took from the mainstream of the society kind of enmeshed our family in a network of experiences that were very important in helping us achieve our goals.
My guest is James Comer, and he's a professor of psychiatry at Yale Child Study Center and the author of a new family memoir called Maggie's American Dream. Now, your parents were very strict, and you know, even the neighbors would sometimes mock your mother for being as strict with her children
right.
as she was. And I wonder what it was like for you growing up. You know, these are things we frequently appreciate more in retrospect
right.
than at the time. Were you ever a little embarrassed by how strict your parents were, or, you know, a little frustrated at it?
Well, sometimes we were embarrassed, and sometimes we were angry. And yet, we had good times at home. And so my mother's insistence that we come home at a certain time, you know, it'd be frustrating to have to leave basketball games or leave standing on the street corner talking with the guys to come home. On the other hand, there were four of us about the same age and my older sister, and we had good times. We had debates at home, and there were a whole variety of things that we did at home that were very exciting. On the other hand, there were times when she made you pretty angry. I know there were times that she would tell me things and insist that I do things certain ways. And I would pretend or act like I didn't like that, didn't believe that, didn't think it was a good idea. And I'd go away giving her the impression that I wasn't going to do it her way. But I figured out very early that my mother was often right. And so as soon as I'd get away from her, I'd do it the way she suggested. I just didn't give her the satisfaction of knowing that I did it her way.
Since she was so absorbed with the idea of getting a good education, if you brought home grades that were that didn't quite make it, would she punish you, get angry with you?
No, she never punished. She would show dissatisfaction, but most of the times we made very good grades. It was only in college where I had strange grades one semester. There was very interesting interaction. One year I came home with two A's, a B, and an F, and I was really very frustrated and angry and disappointed and upset and confused, and I couldn't really figure out what was going on. And in part, what was going on was the racist incidents and so on that I was dealing with in college that really confused me, that made me begin to do self-destructive things. And so I had stopped studying physics about halfway through the semester and gotten an F in the course. Part of that, as I look at it now, was really a test of my mother and her feelings about me. My feeling had been, a part of me felt that the only reason she cared about me was for my performance and what we achieved and accomplished. And when I got that F, my mother said, "You know, your grades are uneven, and I know you can do better." And she wanted to find out what was going on. I was so confused and upset, I really couldn't respond. She finally said to me, "You know, it's important for you to do well, and we want you to succeed. We want you to become a doctor, but your health is the most important thing." And that was the thing that really kind of took the monkey off my back. I knew then that they cared about me, and my achievement was secondary. And that really freed me up and allowed me to go back and take on all of those difficult circumstances in college and also achieve at a high level.
When you were in public school, you went to schools that were predominantly white until black students from a nearby overcrowded school were bused in. And then when you went to college as an undergraduate, it was also a predominantly white school, Indiana University.
Right.
And you said it wasn't until you got to college that you were really aware of the fact that you were from a lower income background, and that the fact that you got good grades in public school wasn't going to necessarily mean anything in the larger arena of college.
Right. Well, good grades in elementary school and high school were really protective because people respected you for that and for your ability, teachers, students, and so on. And you really didn't have to deal with the fact of being black and from a low-income background. There were no implications, negative implications, for the most part, although there were some racial incidents in elementary school, middle school, and high school. But for the most part, they were minor. In college, there were lots of people who were good students and good athletes and in lots of activities. And so those things that protected me in elementary school and high school were no longer protective in college. And so I had to deal with lots of racial incidents, sense of rejection without the kind of protective things that worked in school. First day on Indiana University campus, a half block off the campus, I was thrown out of a sweet shop because I was black. Second day, we went to an orientation session, and it rained. They came up with cars, administrators, teachers, and picked up the students who were standing in rain. Two white students got in the car. I got in, and the rest of the white students refused to get into the car. They preferred to stand in the rain. Those were just devastating kinds of experiences to, as a freshman, frightened in the first place and so on. That and many other things really got me off to a bad start. Well, I was about to recover.
Uh-huh.
And I had a composition course where I was doing very well. The papers were graded anonymously by the professor, and he was reading one of my compositions as an example of an A theme in the classroom. About halfway through, he had a question, and he asked, "Whose paper is this?" And I raised my hand, And from that point on, he ripped the paper to shreds. Everything was wrong with it from that point. And all of those things together were just devastating to the point that really made me have a very difficult first year. And then up and down over my period at Indiana until that incident that my mother really helped me deal with and helped me go out and then achieve at a high level.
Well, you decided to attend medical school at a black college, went to Howard University for medical school.
Yes.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I had just kind of had it with all of the things you had to deal with. It wasn't enough to be a good student, and it wasn't enough to be a good person. There was something else they were asking for, and I didn't have it. And so I was tired of having to prove something all of the time. And so I decided to go to a predominantly black school. As I pointed out in the book, that being a black student at a predominantly white school was like playing all of your home basketball games on an away court. That instead of getting cheers for your performance, you often got jeers and worse. And I was just tired of it. And so I decided to go to Howard. And yet, at Howard, I realized that all the problems of the world weren't racial, and that there were a lot of people problems. And on the other hand, Howard was a very good experience in that it introduced me to a lot of other blacks who were high achievers, who were committed to trying to bring about change. It introduced me to high-achieving black professionals, and so it was a good experience. Both experiences together were very important to me.
Well, I want to talk about your work as an educator, how you became an educator, and what kind of experimental programs you've designed. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is James Comer. He's a professor of child psychiatry and author of the family memoir, Maggie's American Dream. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Comer, and he's just written an autobiography of his family titled Maggie's American Dream. It tells how his mother, who was uneducated, raised five children and made sure they went to college. They all became successful, and James Comer has become a leading figure in the field of education. He's a professor of psychiatry at the Yale Child Study Center and associate dean of the Yale School of Medicine. You had planned on becoming a medical practitioner. But then you turned to child psychiatry and to education. And I was wondering if you could explain what was responsible for that change.
Yes, when I finished medical school and did my internship in my hometown, I began to do some moonlighting during my internship, and I was exposed again to the black community much more. And I began to see a level of poverty that shocked me. People were depressed. Many of my own friends who had been bright and able people in high school were on a downhill course in life and depressed and living under terrible conditions. And I began to ask myself, what's going on here? And rather than going into general practice, I decided to go into the service to give myself a chance to really think about what was going on and what I wanted to do. While in the service, I got involved with a volunteer agency helping people who had been thrown off of public welfare. And I remember a youngster going off to school asking his mother, who had been moving from one place to another, and all of their goods were out in the front of this house that we had. The youngster went off saying, "Where will I find you this evening?" And it occurred to me, it must be very difficult to study when you don't know where you're going to find your mother in the evening and concentrate and to commit yourself to learning. And there were a number of other incidents that showed the insensitivity of schools to some of the problems of low-income children. One youngster crying in a corner, when I asked him what was wrong, he said his teacher told him that if he couldn't bring a dime back for the Easter egg hunt, he should not come back. I went out to NIMH as I looked at the stress these families were under and the children were under. It was clear to me that these were bright children, but that if they didn't get a good education, they were going to end up on the day labor market that was right across the street. So I went out to see what they were doing in National Institute of Mental Health to try and prevent such problems and kind of stress the children experienced and their families were experiencing. And they convinced me to join the Public Health Service and go on to the University of Michigan to get an MPH, and eventually into I went into child psychiatry with the notion that maybe we could prevent the problems that children families were experiencing if we could get to the children very early. And then realize that the place that you could do that, and really the first place in our society, was in the public school. And that's why I began to look to the school as a place to make a difference.
You created an experimental program that was first started in two New Haven public elementary schools. When you first entered those schools, you were really unprepared for the lack of control that the teachers were able to get over the children and for the chaos that ruled in the schools.
Well, I was totally unprepared because my own experience had been so very different, and I didn't understand what was creating the kind of conditions, the chaotic conditions, the anger that the parents had with school people and the school people with the parents and the custodian, and it was just chaotic, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And eventually, I had to apply the knowledge I gained growing up in my family to that situation, and using my training as a psychiatrist, and that combination really made it possible for us to bring about change in that school.
When you say apply the lessons that you learned in your own family, do you mean look at what you had, what you thought these students might not have had,
and figure out
how to give it to them?
So
how did that translate in terms of the program that you designed?
Well, I know that as I looked back and asked, what was the difference between me and, say, my three buddies that I went off to school to kindergarten with, who were from the same neighborhood, black youngsters, just as able, just as bright. The difference was I had received a home experience that gave me the skills and the confidence to go into the public school, a demanding school serving the highest socioeconomic children, and present myself in a way that elicited a positive response from school people. Now, also, my parents had the ability, when there was a problem, to go into the school and interact with school people in a way so that when they came out, things were better off for us. And I realized that that was very important, that the relationship between home and school had to be a good one, because both the parents and the teachers are a part of the motivation process for the children. Children imitate, identify with, and internalize the attitudes, values, and ways of their parents and their children, and that's how they learn, and that's how academic learning becomes important to them. It's through that relationship.
How did you get the parents more involved in the school so that you'd have them more involved in their children's lives and you'd have them on your side?
Yeah, well, you had to create a condition of mutual trust and mutual respect, and what we did to do that was to create a governance and management body made up of parents, teachers, and administrators, and our mental health team people, and also non-professional support staff. And that group together planned the academic and social program of the school. They all had a stake in it. They all got to know each other as people with mutual interests rather than enemies, and so trust and mutual respect began to develop.
How do you deal with troublemakers now? Do you have a different way of dealing with the troublemakers than you think the average public school does?
Well, we didn't look at them as troublemakers. One of the problems for low-income children or children from families under stress is that they grow up in environments where they are prepared for conditions in that environment, but not for the mainstream school expectations. A child might be told at home that you've got to fight if somebody bothers you. You're told at school that you can't fight. And so many other things like that cause the children to go to school presenting themselves in ways that get them into trouble.
So that's what you mean by teaching them new social skills.
That's right. And not only behavior, but not only not fighting, but many, many other things. The other thing is that too many people think of learning as a kind of mechanical process. You know, you turn on your learning machine if you want to, and you turn it off if you don't want to, and that is just willful not learning. Learning is really a relationship issue as much as it is a kind of cognitive mechanical process. We learn in part because the meaningful people around us want us to learn. There is no difference between a nonsense syllable and an A the only reason a child learns that one is useful and that you make it in a certain way and pronounce it in a certain way is because a meaningful other, a caretaker that's meaningful to you, wants you to learn that. And so the relationship is critically important. And that's what we did in our school program, was to change the climate of relationships, create a good climate, make it possible for the children to have good relationships with the adults around them, and for those adults to be in agreement. And because of that, the children in our school program went from being 32nd and 33rd in achievement, 19 and 18 months behind by the fourth grade, to being tied for third, tied for fourth highest achievement in the city, and also best attendance records and no serious behavior problems, because we changed the climate of relationships and made it possible for them to achieve.
Do you ever find yourself paraphrasing advice that your mother gave you and passing it on to students now?
I find myself all the time. As a matter of fact, while interviewing my mother, we were talking about child rearing once, and she began to sound so much like me, and I've written a child care book, and I panicked, and I thought maybe she's not giving me her own opinions. Maybe she's telling me something she read in my book. Then I realized my mother doesn't have an education, and she doesn't sit around reading books. And that, in fact, I had been reading her book, that much of what I believed and understood understand to be effective in working with children really came from my own personal experience, and that I was applying that, and I had modified it or so, but that these basic ideas really came from her own child-rearing ideas.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your family and about your work as an educator. Thank you.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
My guest has been James Comer, and his new book is titled Maggie's American Dream, The Life and Times of a Black Family. It's published by New American Library. Comer is a professor of psychiatry at the Yale Child Study Center, and he writes a column for Parents Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.